Hello and welcome to the next podcast of the Review of Democracy, the journal of the CEU Democracy Institute. My name is Robert Németh, and our topic today is Cyprus Confidential, a recent project of the International Consortium of Investigative Journalists. We have two guests today, Dean Starkman, ICIJ's senior editor, and senior reporter Neil Weinberg. Welcome to the show.
Good to be with you, Robert.
Thank you much.
My first question is, what is Cyprus Confidential about? Can you please summarize the most important findings of the investigation?
Yeah, Cyprus Confidential is a project of ICIJ and its media partners based on leaks of confidential data from a handful of Cyprus-based offshore service providers, largely. And these are the companies that help rich people, typically, often people with something to hide, to set up anonymous companies registered in Cyprus or other offshore jurisdictions, British Virgin Islands, Panama, what have you. And these companies are able to open and own bank accounts. And from there, these wealthy individuals typically can move money around the world without detection by outside authorities. And as we have exposed over the years at ICIJ, this offshore financial system, it's essentially a playground for tax evasion, money laundering, and other criminality. The whole system is set up, again, to evade scrutiny from external authorities and to hide who is moving the money. And in this case, ICIJ came up with a round of findings that found that the overwhelming dominance of Russian money and Russian influence in Cyprus, an EU member state whose banking system is overseen by the European Central Bank, and these offshore service professionals helping a range of oligarchs, all of them sort of a who's who of Putin's inner circle, move their wealth, and often moving their wealth to evade Western sanctions, including those that came after the full-scale invasion of Ukraine, as well as many more that came after the annexation and occupation of Crimea in 2014.
I think one thing that I would add is that it was somewhat notable to see that the offshore service providers Dean mentioned, these were largely Cypriot companies that were, you know, financial service providers in Cyprus, but they were very much plugged into brand name Western financial service firms, the accounting firm PwC, also known as PricewaterhouseCoopers. And when we were doing the research into these 3.2 million documents, repeatedly, the names of A-list banks and other financial service providers in the West, whether you're talking about Switzerland or the US or Western Europe, their names came up over and over again. That doesn't mean that they were directly involved in any wrongdoing, but it does illustrate how this system is very much plugged into the Western financial system, that it is designed to wall off from all of these bad places.
And just to follow up on that, because Neil makes some kind of a crucial point, we're sort of become used to pointing the finger of blame at so-called corrupt jurisdictions like Cyprus or Bulgaria or Malta. But it's very important to recognize that the offshore financial system is a Western financial system. And there's nothing more connected than finance, because finance, all banks are interconnected, and all of them tie back either to the European Central Bank or the U.S. Federal Reserve. So all of this took place under the nose of Western authorities, Western finance. And I think it's convenient for Western financial interests and Western authorities to point the finger of blame at places like Cyprus, which deserve it, don't get me wrong. But again, these are these firms, these jurisdictions, indeed, are in some ways acting in service of a larger Western financial interest.
Yes, and just to sort of add one thought on Dean's point, one of the most notorious secrecy jurisdictions for illicit money in the world is the U.S. state of Delaware.
I have three follow-up questions to what you said. So let's start with the first one. You mentioned Russian oligarchs uncovered in the investigation, and there were names like Roman Abramovich, Sergei Roldugin, or Alexei Mordashov. Who were the most significant players uncovered in the investigation, in addition to them, and why are they important?
I think it's important to say that you might not be able to rank one, two, three, but it was notable that this year, 2023, Forbes magazine identified 105 Russian billionaires. And of those 105 Russian billionaires, ICIJ found that two-thirds of them were funneling money through Cyprus. So I think it shows you that this is a very big funnel for a lot of Russian money. And this is money that is owned or controlled by oligarchs who are in Vladimir Putin's inner circle or are otherwise industrialists or financiers in Russia who obviously are beholden to the Russian regime. And certainly their assets are beholden to the Russian regime's war in Ukraine.
Let me add to that good point, because what was kind of eye-opening for me writing a story for this project and also editing it was the discovery of the centrality of Cyprus to the Putin financial system. Cyprus isn't just a gateway of the Russian regime to the West. It's the principal one. It's how Russia plugs itself into the Western financial system. And just the data just tells you the story. Russia had, according to the Center for the Study of Democracy, a very good think tank in Sofia, Bulgaria, the Russia over the years has had $400 billion of foreign direct investment in Europe. Half of that went through Cyprus. Cyprus has a population of less than 1% of the European Union. It's an enormous amount of money. Now, and essentially all of those, that money bloated the Cyprus banking system, enriched a fairly substantial and highly politically wired cadre of professionals in Cyprus itself, which had essentially captured the Cypriot government. So when you're looking at that stat that we had, that Neil just cited, this, you know, there are however many he said, 100 and change Russian billionaires on the Forbes list. Our leak found more than half of them using Cyprus as a financial center. It's absolutely pivotal to the Putin model, the Putin financial regime.
I think it's also notable that Cyprus' business of laundering the money or hiding the money of ultra wealthy individuals around the world, as Dean pointed out, it is dominated by Russians, but it's not only Russians. We also found, for example, there were transactions that appeared to be linked to the Assad regime in Syria. There were transactions that were linked to a U.S. billionaire who was involved in the disappearance of $300 million in pension money in the Caribbean. So there were lots of bad actors beyond Russia who are turning to Cyprus, but clearly the Russians are the 800-pound gorilla in the Cypriot financial services business.
Right. And the reason this is important is Putin regime's model is based on the offshore system. It is a vital component of how Putin accumulated and gained power. How does that happen? What happens is that Putin, early in his regime in the early 2000s, began to use the state essentially to confiscate assets and place them in the hands from oligarchs who are not friendly to him or not connected to him, to those that were. And the mechanism by which this works is the money is moved off out of Russia, again, overwhelming proportion of it through Cyprus, through Cypriot registered companies, Cypriot registered banks. It pings around Europe, including going to Netherlands and Austria. And again, this is all based on Center for the Study of Democracy data. And then is reinvested back in, often, either it's hidden offshore in in the form of yachts and stocks and real estate in London and fancy apartments in Miami Beach. It's stored as a war chest for Putin to use to undermine Western democracies. And it's reinvested back into the Russian economy, this time in the hands of Putin allies. And so what you essentially had was, and it's one of the things that's also just as shocking, is the amount of money that Cyprus received from Russia, the proportion of it, half of it. But Cyprus is probably the leading investor in Russia, even though it's this tiny country. Why? Because Cypriot registered companies are the owners of a vast amount of Russian assets. Bottom line and net result was Putin started with allies who controlled a small portion of the Russian economy to, at the end of the process, thanks to Cyprus, among other things, to having huge sway over a large part of Russian manufacturing industry and energy.
I think it's also notable that it appears that the Russian money that goes through Cyprus is not all the result of the same incentive. I think in some cases, the oligarchs are hedging their bets. If they fall out of favor with Putin, they have a nice stash overseas. At the same time, as Dean mentioned, some of this money gets reinvested into Russia, or Putin may have a call option. If he decides that he needs money for some purpose, whether it's the Ukraine war or to keep his population satisfied in some way, he can lean on these oligarchs to repatriate the money. Also, we saw indications that an individual known as Putin's wallet, a person who is believed to have helped move about $2 billion in assets out of Russia on behalf of Putin, the individual, also shows up in the data in the Cyprus confidential databases. So there are multiple purposes that the Russians can achieve by using Cyprus as their offshore haven.
Why do you think it is Cyprus that became such a hub? Why not another country?
Fair question. I did a little a trip down Cyprus history. There are, first, you got to remember Cyprus's geographic strategic location, easternmost frontier of Europe. It's a stone's throw from Syria and Lebanon. There's been longstanding cultural ties between Russia and Cyprus, based initially on the common Eastern Orthodox religion. And during the Cold War, Cyprus, there was a really close ties, interestingly, between the Cypriot Communist Party and the Russian Communist Party, with lots of cultural and educational exchanges, lots of intermarriage, all sorts of trade and most also cultural, social, and educational ties that really cemented the relationship, the cultures of those two countries pretty closely together. So that when, and it was, as I think I'm right, remembering right, Cyprus was one of the few places that when the Berlin Wall fell, Russians could go and without a visa. And it became almost a natural kind of sort of receiving point for Russian money during the tumultuous 1990s after the Berlin Wall fell, and you know, Russian society was, the rule of law was weak, Russian society was in chaos, and a lot of money started to roll into Cyprus just sort of spontaneously, and it really accelerated. I mean, it was almost turbocharged in the early 2000s after Putin took office, and after a while, it became much more systematic as Russian institutions and Russian deposits moved into Cyprus and essentially bloated the banking system, the real estate market, and otherwise. And as we sort of describe in the project and in my story, there arose a professional class of lawyers, accountants, some of them linked to Western brand names like PwC, bankers, all came to sort of serve this demand that basically began to funnel through Cyprus.
Cyprus also implemented a so-called golden visa and golden passport program, which was very abundantly used by Russian individuals. And essentially what it did was enabled non-Cypriot citizens to apply and in many cases obtain Cypriot citizenship in exchange for investing 2 million euros in Cyprus. And obviously for a Russian oligarch, 2 million euros is not a stretch. It's an easy down payment to make on a passport, which then gives them membership in the European Union. And obviously with that comes free access to travel around the European Union, something that many Russians over time haven't had the ability to do. So it gives them that freedom. It gives them that sort of emergency exit should things go badly for them at home. Another thing that you could add to the appeal of Cyprus is it's 3 hours by plane from Moscow and it's warm. So lots of reasons why Cyprus.
And you can't leave out the fact that it's corrupt, period, full stop. I mean, that what happened was this professional class of service providers, lawyers, bankers, and accountants essentially merged in a very symbiotic relationship, almost indistinguishable from the Cyprus government. And in sort of the apotheosis of this model was the president of Cyprus from 2013 until actually early this year, President Nikos Anastasiadis, who was the founder of literally an offshore service provider firm, and then moved on to serve as the president of the country during a time of great economic activity between Cyprus and Russia that concluded many economic and financial deals with Putin himself. And meanwhile, his former firm, he stepped away from it in 2013, continued to operate, including with partners that included his two daughters.
Regulators, either in Cyprus or in the EU, make any mistakes to let it happen? Is it about loopholes in the legislation or about enforcing the law? Or what enables these offshore systems to operate?
The problem in Cyprus and elsewhere is, and the problem with the anti-money laundering regime globally, is all of the rules and regulations are in place. All the agencies are there. The question is always boils down to enforcement. And you can have all sorts of performative legislation passed, regulations issued, and even the occasional enforcement action that doesn't affect anybody too important. But in the end, anti-money laundering enforcement requires action. Somebody has to do something. And for the offshore system to work, for money laundering to occur, all that has to happen is that the system has to do nothing, and do nothing it actually does. And so we cite a statistic that the UN came up with a few years ago that showed that 99% of all laundered money goes undetected. Again, all of these systems can be set up and put in place, but unless you actively pursue the actual owner of the offshore company, if you required banks to block transactions of accounts held by companies that they don't know the beneficial owners of, then anti-money laundering enforcement gains traction. On the other hand, if you do nothing, you have a very shiny system to show the world, and the money laundering continues beneath the surface.
And obviously, one of the problems with the enforcement is that in countries around the world, it is often the people who make the laws or enforce the laws or oversee those who are enforcing the laws who cut corners, who have money they want to hide. So similar in Cyprus, it's possible that the Cypriot government could be much more aggressive in stamping out illicit flows of money, but by doing so, they would also be doing damage to their own economy and their own businesses. So clearly there's a conflict of interest there. And this is the sort of conflict which sort of raises risks for the operation of democracy in general.
Yeah, again, you can't just put it on Cyprus, because in 2020, we did something called the FinCEN files, which showed that literally trillions of dollars, and literally, if it's a dollar, it goes ultimately, every dollar transaction is made in Lower Manhattan. The term cross-border transaction is actually a misnomer. If it's a dollar transaction, these are made by foreign banks that all have accounts that tie back, that rest in Lower Manhattan in financial institutions there. JP Morgan has correspondent relationships with banks around the world. They all, to do the dollar transaction, has to be done through JP Morgan. Deutsche Bank is a German bank, but actually it has an American bank branch in Lower Manhattan that is regulated by the Federal Reserve. All dollar transactions are done in New York. Point being, if you wanted to, if you're FinCEN, if you wanted to forbid transactions where the bank is unsure of who the sender or the recipient is, you know, you could forbid those, but they don't. When you talk about the trouble with money laundering, is there's everyone has a great interest in making sure that these transactions flow, and very few people have a real monetary interest in making sure that they are stopped. And the same thing you could sort of argue is with, it also helps explain the story of Russian investment in Cyprus and in the West. Yes, we understood, particularly after 2014, that the Putin regime was an adversary to Western interests, and sanctions began to be imposed on certain Russian institutions, but the money continued to flow, and the foreign direct investment continued into Europe via Cyprus, because in European and Western financial players have an interest in Russian money flowing, and that's, you know, you have to sort of look at the most obvious motivation for why things look the way they look. And again, it's important to remember, for money laundering to occur, all that authorities have to do is nothing.
I think a prime example of how this occurred in Cyprus is PwC. And I'll cite one example. PwC has a large operation in Cyprus. We're talking over 1,000 employees in this small island. And a large chunk of their business historically has been with Russians. And one of the examples of communication between PwC and a local Cypriot service provider that was an offshoot of PwC was an email chain in which an authority at PwC was admonishing a colleague at this other company, saying, yes, the owners, the beneficial owners of this company, they themselves are under Western sanctions, but the company is not itself under Western sanctions. So we are under no legal prohibitions from doing business with this company. So they know that they are violating the spirit of the law, perhaps not the letter of the law. They know that they are helping people that the West is trying to stop from accessing the Western financial system. And yet they're willing to do it. They're willing to play it cute, to play by the letter of the law, and basically undermine Western interests. And they have no problem with that.
Now, again, and to continue this point, PwC is based in London. It has a major presence in the US. PwC, as the story that Neil and Spencer Woodman wrote, makes clear, PwC is very careful to structure its organization so that the subsidiaries, the units offshore and around the world are separate legal entities. However, one shouldn't be naive. PwC is embedded in the U.S. financial system. It is absolutely a crucial player for some massive number of publicly traded companies, including some of the biggest ones. It's one of the big four accounting firms. The idea that the US and UK financial authorities have no influence whatsoever over PwC's behavior and have no leverage over them is preposterous. And that's sort of where we start to sort of think about why this Cyprus looks the way it does, why we keep returning to the same names over and over again, including PwC. We have a story that basically talks about the various times PwC has been compromised. It has been caught in compromised positions with individuals who are under sanction or otherwise sideways of the law. And yet it keeps recurring. I guess on this point, I want to just sort of point out again this idea that at the end, it kind of goes back to what's really at play when it comes to the authorities who actually have enormous power over the financial system in Frankfurt and Brussels and in New York and Washington. That may be the next project, but that's sort of the questions I think your listeners need to sort of think about.
There's also obviously a huge flaw in the structure of Western finance. Namely, many of these institutions, whether it's PricewaterhouseCoopers or Deutsche Bank or JP Morgan or Goldman Sachs, are too big to fail. No matter how egregious some of their behavior is, and they are serial offenders, as we point out with PwC around the world, regulators and law enforcement are not going to put them out of business. They're just too big and too integrated into the financial system. So for these organizations, they scatter their units around the world. They separate them with legal liability from each other's legal liability. And then if they get caught every now and then, which in PwC's case is pretty often and pretty regularly, it's a cost of doing business, but it is not an existential threat to them. Regulators and law enforcement are very well aware that this is the structure they're living with, and either they don't have the will or they don't have the motivation to change this. So the system operates the way it does. It is inherently corrupt, and there's no reason to think that's going to change anytime soon.
Yeah, it does kind of tie back to politics and the political and financial interests that are at play. And you, when you look at a place like Cyprus, you do have to pull the camera back and look at the wider picture, because Cyprus is part of a larger system. I'll use one example that I really fixed on in my piece, which was this bank called RCB Bank, which used to be known as Russian Commercial Bank. And essentially, it started out as a wholly owned subsidiary of VTB Bank, which is which is openly controlled by the Kremlin in Moscow, and it never really succeeded in distancing itself. No one believed that RCB Bank in Cyprus, which was the third and fourth largest bank, depending on the year, in Cyprus, its deposits were larger than the entire gross domestic product of Cyprus, and its managers were all former VTB executives. The ties were deep, and to the point that in 2015, at a press conference, Vladimir Putin himself mistakenly referred to RCB as a VTB subsidiary. Everyone basically knew that they were tied cheek by jowl, and yet the RCB was a systemically significant bank, directly supervised by the European Central Bank, out in the open. Everybody saw it. You could say, well, you know, there's only so much that the ECB could do. The ECB is a central bank. They hold their license. They have all sorts of authority over vetting of shareholders, vetting of officers and directors, et cetera. And what was really significant to me, what sort of kind of got my attention, was RCB had operated basically with impunity since the 1990s through the Crimea War, when its parent, VTB, was under sanction, until March of 2022, a month after the Ukraine invasion, when all of a sudden it decides voluntarily to leave the banking business. And the ECB pulls its license. Well, there's a story to be pursued there as to why, after 20, 30 years, a very profitable and super liquid with abundant capital bank would just decide to get out of business. But people have clear that regulators decided it's clear. I don't want to speculate. All I want to say is one day RCB was in business, and the next day it's not. And when you talk about, when you sort of, you start to think about the sway that regulators have over regulated institutions. When they want to use it, they can. And I think that's sort of, these are the things that I think people need to be sort of smart about when they're thinking about a place like Cyprus, a project like Cyprus Confidential. It's very important to both recognize that Cyprus was an active, willing, hyper-conscious player in this essentially a Putin money machine. But again, it was part of a larger system, and that larger system also needs to be called to account.
Can you explain our listeners what it looks like when you work on such projects? So in this project, the ICIJ had 68 different partners and some 270 journalists in many different countries, if I'm not mistaken. So this requires a lot of coordination. How can you manage it? How do you work when you have such projects?
With great difficulty, I guess would be the short answer. But I will say, and I don't want to, you know, I'm going to toot ICIJ's horn a little bit because I kind of don't have anything to do with it. But this model that they came up with, this idea of collaborative journalism, was pioneered by a great American journalist named Chuck Lewis, who was one of the founders of the Center for Public Integrity, which was the original parent of ICIJ. And it started with, I mean, the idea of cooperation among news organizations was itself revolutionary. It happened in the 90s, back when that was absolutely unheard of. And when Gerard Ryle came in 2013, he kind of brought the whole offshore savvy to the thing, including a database, the first set that became the what were known as offshore leaks. What ICIJ has done, and just kind of over the years really, really kind of figured it out, is how to both get leaks, either by ourselves or from partners, clean and assemble the data, which is a massive job. Trust me. We're talking about, you know, these are, I'm not a tech person. Somebody tells me a gigabyte is a lot. I'll believe it. But these are files from law firms and accounting firms and firms that come in all sorts of formats, Excel spreadsheets and PDF files and emails. All sorts of stuff has to be kind of pulled out, structured, put into fields and made searchable. All of this has to be then uploaded onto a very secure server that's the platform itself is called DataShare, built by ICIJ. Again, I'm tooting our horn, but it's true. There's some things we do good. We do really good. Again, it has nothing to do with me. We also built a secure communications platform called the iHub. And believe me, these are places that have been that people want to hack into. A lot of people, you know, who with malevolent intent, it's never happened. And then we after kind of going through the data, which is a real, you know, you have to kind of sift through. It's very mind numbing, but you figure out what you've got and you start to invite people, that is to say media organizations around the world in. We found something in the Czech Republic, say, for instance, here's, we ask our Czech partners in, et cetera, et cetera. That kind of goes in, you know, the UK always has something, the US, wish there was more, but there's all these kind of things we have. Anyway, so you get to the number 68 or however many we had this time. And we had some ridiculous number in Pandora Papers. I can't remember what it was. Over 100, maybe over 2. Anyway, it was crazy. We had 600 reporters working on that thing. The two rules that ICIJ has are real simple, but you have to abide by them. One, you have to stick to the deadline. Nobody jumps ahead. Two, when you find something, you share it and you put that up on iHub and you say, here's what I found. Hey, look, blah, blah, blah. And everybody kind of talks and communicates. iHub looks like, you know, a hot mess basically sometimes just because it just becomes a sprawling number of topics and conversations and stuff. We try to organize as best we can. Anyway, that's how it works. And then everybody, we meet periodically in the old days and we're going to do this again as soon as we can. But before the pandemic, we would actually have a in-person meeting in some place, might be Hamburg or Paris or Washington, and talk about what we're going to try and do. 6 months later, 9 months later, we're all going to publish at the same time. We all come to an agreement on the date. And every month or so, we have a fairly giant video call where everybody sort of talks about what they're doing. Essentially, that's sort of the nutshell version of how ICIJ works, how cross-border collaborations work, and all of that kind of papers over a lot of blood, sweat, and tears and trying to make this whole thing come together. There's more components, which I could get into, but that's sort of the basics of it. And the reason I'm kind of like pounding the drum for ICIJ is that, this model works, and now it's not common. Other organizations and collaborations are springing up, both ad hoc and formal. And God bless, that's a good thing. That's a good thing. But, I think it's worth reminding the world that we kind of have the model down. And I'm just going to, that's where I'll stop the commercial. But, these are tough to pull off. And I have a very small role in it, but they managed to do it time after time. I think it's notable.
I can just add a few thoughts as a relative newcomer to this. I worked from this summer on this particular project, and I was certainly familiar with ICIJ and had many times read its articles, over the years. I'd spent a lot of time doing financial investigations at Bloomberg, at Forbes, and I'd never saw a model like ICIJ's. The partnership model is both really strong and really challenging. I'll tell you just one challenge. There was a partner meeting some months ago to try to decide when the launch date for this project, Cyprus Confidential, would be. There were numerous partners from numerous countries. Just two of the challenges. In one country, it was a national holiday. And another country, there were some soccer finals. So, neither of those were acceptable. And you're just trying to balance all of these different interests in terms of times and dates and holidays and production schedules and everything else. It's a pretty daunting thing. But as Dean mentioned, there are two basic tools. One is the data and the database, which I found tremendously, easy to use given how large it is. It can be somewhat mind-numbing to go through 3.2 million documents, and there's no easy way. But the fact that you can search it, that these documents are translated and so on, gives you tremendous access as a financial journalist to say, holy cow, we're looking through all these documents, internal communications, financial statements, and so on. Nobody else has access to them. And, the tools to both view them and to share them with your partners are very slick. And the partners, in my view, coming from organizations that largely operated on their own, was really strong. As Dean said, there seems to be an ethos that people will share what they find, and they will say, hey, I went through these documents, here's a link to them, here's what I found. And then someone else will say, here's some more. And 3 days later, there's a bunch more. So you have this running commentary as the group collectively builds knowledge about something. And the old adage is that all news is local, and Cyprus Confidential was a good example of that. For example, there was a very prominent journalist and commentator in Germany. He was well known for his books on Putin in Russia, for his television specials on Putin in Russia, and he was considered a leading expert in Germany on Russia and Putin. He'd spent much time with Putin. Well, a German partner noticed his name in some of these Cyprus Confidential documents. And as one of our stories indicated, he received somewhere in the neighborhood of $700,000 from an oligarch who is very close to Vladimir Putin. His publisher, as we noted later, immediately took his books off the market. And this is the kind of journalism that has impact. The Guardian, a British publication, saw information about a Russian billionaire, Abramovich, and he had owned one of the best-known soccer/football teams in the United Kingdom, Chelsea FC, and saw documents indicating that he had spread money around that was contrary to professional soccer rules. and may have given him an unfair advantage and his team an unfair advantage. So this is the sort of specialty or the expertise that you get when you bring in local partners to look for local angles to local stories.
Probably worth mentioning that everybody is cooperates, and that's great. It's not like, you know, everyone's, you know, an angel or whatever. One of the reasons it works is that we try to keep and usually keep partners to one per country. So they're not really, nobody's competing against each other head to head within their own market. So everyone's comfortable kind of like knowing that their scoop is going to be theirs in the end. They're all on their own. And there's not like any overwhelming incentive to jump the deadline, because then you'll just annoy, you know, everyone, people, your partners around the world, and you gain basically nothing. So, you know, it works because it's realistic. Everybody operates within sort of their normal kind of journalistic interests.
Those who are exposed by such investigations quite often start to attack the journalists themselves by lawsuits, or can be even personal threats. Did you experience anything like this?
I think it's fair to say there were, at least from what I saw, there were threats of lawsuits. There was certainly some feedback from some of the subjects of the story saying it was all, you know, inaccurate and wrong and misleading. So yes, there was certainly pushback, and in some cases there was just silence. So I think it was all of the above, some threats, some silence.
Yeah, just certainly over the years, partners have faced legal threats, especially in Central and South America, threats of police action, prosecution, those kind of things, as well as, of course, physical threats. And this does happen. And in Russia in particular, our partners, iStories and others, have had to essentially move out of the country because they were labeled, whatever they label them, foreign agents or undesirable organizations or other kind of very menacing legal threats. So far, we've managed to avoid anything along, you know, that to that kind of level. One thing I think is that I think I call it our secret sauce is our fact-checking operation led by a gentleman named Rick Sia, which is about as rigorous as you're going to get. If you get your facts in order, you know, that's not a panacea for every threat imaginable, but it goes a real long way. And it's one of the most important, absolutely most important functions at ICIJ, no doubt.
Yeah, but in my experience, it was a fact-checking process that was so thorough. I haven't seen it since the 1990s and 2000s at Forbes, back in the days when U.S. magazines were abundantly powerful and prosperous. So for the most part, throughout journalism, this sort of meticulous fact-checking has fallen by the wayside, but ICIJ still does it.
Yeah, and I don't think we could do what we do without it, honestly, and we're all kind of conscious of protecting, quote, the fact-checkers by making sure that they have enough time and space to do their jobs, to stay out of the copy while they're at work. You know, there's all sorts of things that we do that we make sure that they have the ability to get their job, and they will challenge you. They will challenge you on every single thing. Also, should mention again, it's kind of nice to be able to praise your colleagues, because you do when you step back, you do get to appreciate them. But our data team, now led by Delphine Reuter, they did their own fact-checking deal. So every number, everything, every name, every other thing you see that comes from the data, in that has somebody checked that and double checked it. So every time you see 57 and not 56 oligarchs, or so many members of which of this Forbes list, what have you, the stuff that comes out of that data has also been checked within an inch of its life. So that's helps go a long way to protecting us against the kind of threats you're talking about.
Thank you so much for sharing all these insights with us.
Good to be with you.
Thank you all for listening. Please keep listening to our podcasts, following our website, as well as our social media channels. Goodbye.